Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another edition of Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm the host of Heartland Politics, Robin Johnson, and today our topic is former Illinois House Speaker and State Democratic Party Chair Mike Madigan. My guest is Ray Long, a veteran reporter who wrote a new book about Madigan called The House That Madigan Built, The Record Run of Illinois' Velvet Hammer. Now, before we start, for full disclosure, I worked for Mike Madigan for a very brief period of time back in the late 1980s, and I don't feel it affects the objectivity of my questions or statements at all. So we'll proceed with everybody knowing that as background. But I first met Ray Long back when he worked for the Peoria Journal-Star many moons ago, and Ray is now a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Ray, welcome, and thanks a lot for taking the time.
Great to be here, Robin. Thank you for having me.
Your career as a journalist covering Illinois and government politics really parallels mine working in government and politics in Illinois. And this book brought back a lot of memories of people and events. You start out with a key event early on that led to Madigan's ascension as speaker, and that kind of dealt with redistricting when George Ryan, a Republican, was Speaker of the House. What's interesting about that is the vitriol leveled at each other, but maybe share with our viewers the specifics of that story and how that led to Madigan taking over the Speaker's role.
Well, happy to, Robin. That was 1981, my first year there at the legislature. I was an intern working for the Alton Telegraph, and the big redistricting battle is one that comes every 10 years when the census is taken and the district lines are redrawn. And a lot of times it's life and death just because of the way the lines could cut you out of a district or put you into one where you'd have a very tough foe. But this time it was even higher stakes because what happened was this was when they had the cutback amendment. As you know, that was put on the ballot in 1980. Pat Quinn, then a young maverick with the Coalition for Political Honesty, put that the cutback amendment on the ballot that reduced the size of the House from 177 to 118, which it is now. And the reason they did that was because there was a big outcry when there was a lame duck post-election pay raise that was a major pay raise that came in 1978, and there was such a fury over that that Quinn capitalized that and rode that to victory on the cutback amendment. So when you're cutting the size of the House by one third, the idea that a lot of people could be losing their jobs depending on the way the lines are drawn is magnified exponentially. So what happened was George Ryan was Speaker. He was a Republican, obviously, and he pushed through a congressional map by forming a coalition with blacks and whites and making sure that they could get enough votes to put through a map that was favorable to Republicans for the congressional races. But what happened then after that, they had a big fight, the legislative map for the House and Illinois House and Illinois Senate was up for a vote, and Madigan was able to win that, but it all came down to one guy who happened to be from the area that I was covering for the Alton Telegraph, and his name was Gary Hannig, and he had looked at the drawings of the lines, and George Ryan had drawn a lot of downstate lines for Democrats that were very favorable, hoping he could woo some of the Democrats over, and Hannig looked over the lines, and he's like the last guy to vote. He had passed over his name in the roll call, and it comes down to him. The vote is tied, and he can break the tie. And he stands up and says, "Man, this is a very favorable district. I think I could win it here, but I'm gonna stick with my friends that have that are the Democrats and vote no on this map." And so Madigan won that, and Hanig danced with the one who brung him, and as a result, that they couldn't get legislative maps to pass the Republican House and the Democratic Senate. And they went to the commission and to try to find a resolution. And when the commission deadlocked, they had this goofy quirk in the Illinois Constitution where you draw a name to decide which party gets to draw the lines. And the Democrats won. Madigan won. He drew the lines, and he started his 36-year reign as Speaker the very next election.
That drama might only be surpassed by the next story you tell in the book. I kept thinking about that old movie, When the Day the Earth Stood Still, and that, from back in the 1950s. And this is when time stood still in Springfield, with some pretty significant ramifications for one of our professional sports teams in Illinois.
Yeah, this was flash forward to June 1988, and the White Sox looked like they were headed toward St. Petersburg, Florida. They had offered down there in the Sunshine State a chance to build a new stadium and host the White Sox, and made it lucrative with a lot of public finance incentives. And it would have been the first baseball team in Florida. And it looked like they were headed that way, but the White Sox owners here gave Illinois one more shot. And lawmakers all across the country, Illinois lawmakers procrastinate, and it looked like they weren't going to get the job done. It looked like they weren't going to pass a bill. There was a lot of outrage downstate and across the state, of course, because they were fearful that Illinois would be paying too much public money for a stadium, and that's been a debate all over the country. But what they did in Illinois was they tried to put a lot of the costs on tourists by raising rides for rental cars coming out of O'Hare, and also for jacking up hotel taxes here in town. So the argument was that most of the money would be from tourists or people who were in town, and they argued and justified the public money that way. But what happened was, it came down to June 30th, which was the last day of the legislative session, and Jim Thompson had been out and about, and he came back to the Capitol at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and he looked around his office, and all his folks were glum, and they said they didn't think the White Sox bill was going to pass. And he said, "No, this is not going to happen. Chicago has to be a two baseball team town." So he charged upstairs and went and met with Senate Minority Leader Pate Phillip, and said, "Look, I need this. This is personal. We got to have Chicago with two baseball teams, one of the rare cities in America that has two, of course." And he didn't want to see one of them go away. So Phillip starts bringing in some of his Republican folks who had been against the White Sox bill, and Thompson, and he double-teamed them and said, Thompson told each one that it was personal and reminded them of all the things he'd done for them over the years, of course. And then they started flipping votes, but it took a while. Phil Rock was the Senate president. He was a Democrat. He wanted to see the legislation pass. And what happened then was, by the time they all got the votes together or thought they were close, it was at around 11 p.m. and the midnight deadline was bearing down on them. Well, they debated and debated and debated, and then about 12:40, Tim Degnan, who was the senator there, got up and said, "It's the last of the ninth. I hope you all are White Sox fans and we can get enough votes." And they got 30, and Thompson celebrated. That was just the number they needed, and he ran across the rotunda through the crowd of lobbyists, and they swung out open the big wooden doors for the House, and he had spotters standing over lawmakers who wanted to or who were possible folks who could change votes, and he was going desk by desk to try to persuade them. Meanwhile, Madigan was doing the same thing on the other side, and he was working it and working it, and then Thompson flips over to the Democratic side. There were a couple of guys from Peoria, one a Democrat, one a Republican, and they both were against it, but they were both ready to flip, but they wanted the other one to go first, and they kept pointing at each other from across the chamber, and then finally they added their votes on, and the time was ticking down, and there was a radio announcer named Charlie McBaron who was given play-by-play like it was a basketball game in the, you know, seventh game of the World Championship, and he was just doing a fabulous job. He was talking about how Thompson's going here from desk to desk, and Madigan's going here from desk to desk, and I don't know what time they're looking at, because by then the Democrats had disabled the clock, so you couldn't tell what time it was there. So it was getting very close to midnight, and McBaron was broadcasting that I don't know what clock they're looking at, but it's got to be getting very close to midnight, and they're still five or six votes short. So then Jim McPike, the majority leader, kind of nudged Peg Breslin, who was against the White Sox park legislation, out of the chair and took over the gavel, and quickly called for the clerk to take the record, which usually is what the vote total will be, but he didn't slam the gavel. And right then, he kind of looked like a quarterback fading back with 3 seconds on the clock looking for an open receiver downfield, and he starts pointing to lawmakers and says, so-and-so, are you ready to change your vote? And they'd be popping up and saying, I changed my no vote to aye. I changed my no vote to aye. And sooner or later, we're down to 59 votes, and people who were opponents were already given a countdown saying 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. It was like the New Year's Eve ball was dropping in New York Times Square, and others were singing na 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 na, hey hey, just like the when you're pulling a pitcher at the ballpark. And by then, it was clearly after midnight, but Thompson's waving his arms above a Republican, from suburban Republican named Jim Stang, and says, you know, Jim Stang's recognized for a vote, and he says, I changed my vote to yes, and there was pandemonium. The people against were throwing papers up in the air, the bedlam pursued, and Thompson was practically levitating off the floor, and McPike, who had the gavel, then slams it down and says, at 11:59, the bill passes. and then we all ran up to the clerk and got the roll call, and it said 12:03. So we go running out. Thompson's in a reporter's scrum, and one of the reporters is pushing him hard and saying, you know, it's after midnight. And Thompson says, no, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. And then Thompson says, the speaker said it was 11:59, and no court in the land will ever overrule him. And, you know, it went to court. The White Sox bill stood, and even a judge in Florida said, you know what, in recorded history, there's only two times when time stood still. One was in the Judeo-Christian Bible, and one was in the Illinois House of Representatives. And there you have it, Ted. That's how the White Sox bill got passed.
That's Ray Long, veteran reporter for the Chicago Tribune, who is also the author of a recent book called The House That Madigan Built, The Record Run of Illinois' Velvet Hammer. He's been talking a little bit about the rise of Mike Madigan. And my next question is, after this White Sox effort, the bailout, if you want to call it that, when was it this event or another one, Ray, when Mike Madigan kind of developed this mystique? I don't think, and you would know better than me, that he didn't have it at the beginning, but then he kind of developed this aura about him of mystery, so to speak, and the secrecy and the habits every day of going to Saputo's and then having the apple at noon, all these stories we've heard. When did he really, was this the event that really established him as this master, grandmaster at Illinois politics?
Well, Well, that was certainly one that played into it, but we had another follow-up the next year that just really made his legend, if you will, grow, and that was that he had been opposed to Jim Thompson's push to increase the income tax by 40%. It had been 2.5% on individuals, and Thompson wanted to push it to 3.5%. And Madigan had resisted almost robotically, saying every day that he was not convinced that they needed to support Thompson's income tax increase. And then 2.5 years into that, Madigan suddenly switches. And I was with the Peoria Journal-Star then, and Bill O'Connell, who is a legendary reporter and State House reporter and mentor of mine, and Charlie Wheeler of the Sun-Times were two of the papers that had the scoop that Madigan was going to propose his own income tax. It was half the size. It was for a 20%. It was actually 18.4%, and he wanted to move it up closer to 3% rather than Thompson's 3.5%. So what we had here was this gigantic development in the middle of the session where nobody saw it coming. Madigan had kept it secret. He'd kept it sealed. And when the papers, the Sun-Times and the Journal-Star, hit the newsstand, there was sheer bedlam down there again. You know, people were buzzing about it. And Thompson, the governor, didn't even know anything about it, didn't know it was coming, which was part of the mystique and part of the big surprise. So Thompson comes running in, and he's chugging up the grand staircase, and reporters, including me, are running alongside of him to try to get his reaction. He finally stops at the top of the third floor where the House and Senate are, and he was heading back to Mike Madigan's office, and he said, "Look, I want to see if it's true. I want to see if these stories are true," because he had not heard about it. And he looked kind of punch drunk, like he'd gone a couple of rounds with Ken Norton, the world championship boxer from Jacksonville. But he went in there, and Madigan told me later that Thompson came into the office, and Madigan walked over and picked up a newspaper with a headline that the tax increase was his proposal, and he looks at Thompson, holds the paper in the air, and says, "Banzai!" So the bombs were dropping, and Madigan then rolled out the tax increase and pushed it through in less than 6 hours with only Democratic votes, 60 Democrats, and one reporter wrote that the Republicans were scared voteless. They had all, many of them had voted present because they didn't know what to do. They'd supported Thompson's effort, and he was a Republican, and then Madigan came in with his own, and so they negotiated back and forth. It eventually became a 20% increase and passed by the end of the session. And really, that whole operation, which had been very secretive, none of the Republicans knew about it. Thompson didn't know about it, and most of the reporters didn't know about it. He sprung that on everybody, and they called that internally Operation Cobra.
That I would agree that maybe it's that the combination of the White Sox deal and Operation Cobra right in there, that area of the late 80s. But I thought it was interesting, too. And you document the vitriol that Madigan and Ryan threw at each other in that early 80s war over redistricting.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, later on, if you fast forward, Ryan's governor and Madigan speaker, and they work very well together. And I always heard that, you know, it seemed like Mike Madigan worked better with Republican governors than Democratic governors, at least until the Bruce Rauner era, where politics changed and becoming more ideological and negative.
Yeah,
but
I think that's a good analysis there, Robin. And you're right. One thing you touched upon there and I didn't follow up on was how Madigan and Ryan had really been at each other's throats there when Madigan was minority leader. He was not the quiet guy who was secretive at that time when he was minority leader. He was a fiery minority leader, and he Ryan called that big redistricting vote for both Congress and the state legislative maps, those two votes, right during a time when there was an unveiling of a statue of Richard J. Daley in Springfield. And Daley had died about 5 years before, but he had been Madigan's biggest influence. He had been mentor to Mike Madigan, and Madigan was his biggest disciple. But Ryan called for the vote right when they were having this critical vote on the future of legislative politics in Illinois, and it really upset Madigan and some of the other folks who wanted to go to the ceremony. But Ryan said something like, "Well, I'm not gonna let ceremonies get in the way of official important business." But he could have waited, he could have done it earlier, etc. But he just did that to irritate Madigan.
If you read those arguments made, you could flip them now. That Madigan has power and the Republicans don't on keeping the minority disenfranchised, etc., without a voice. It's just a lesson in Madigan's staying power all these years. How, it was always said that all he required of his members was one vote, that he wanted their vote to be for him to be speaker, and other than that, they could vote their districts. You think that held up over the years?
I think so. I think he also wanted them to vote for his rules of the House, too. So the main vote and the key vote, obviously, was vote for him for speaker. But then the second vote that he really wanted also was to have his rules endorsed, too. I'm sure if he had to, he would have traded that off for a vote for speaker. But in the end, as you know, he couldn't get all the votes together and had to step down.
The interesting thing, I guess, as his career progressed, was, of course, the dual scandals here that most folks, listeners, are aware of, where his office operation was caught up in the Me Too movement, sexual harassment scandals by some of his close aides, both in politics and in government, but the ComEd scandal as well, pay to play. You know what struck me was how in the world did Democrats, who normally stand up for the little guy, for consumers, get caught up in enabling legislation by big utilities to pass, which I guess looking back, I'm not sure it was such a good idea from a policy perspective, but was this just the constant pressure to raise money, or were there other factors involved that caused Democrats to kind of flip and be the biggest backers of big utilities in Illinois?
Yeah, it's a real good question. I'm not sure there is a bottom line on that, but what the facts lead you to believe is that they were getting a lot of money from ComEd and other utilities. Ameren also was a big contributor. The utilities passed money around to almost all of the representatives. I think one year we had almost 170 or close to 170 representatives who got some kind of donation, which buys you access, basically. So when you've got a company that's given out thousands of dollars, it helps build relationships over the years. I'm not saying it buys a vote, but it gives you the ability to make your case. And the lobbyists that ComEd had were like an army. They were former Madigan staffers who had become lobbyists for different companies, and they were also lobbying for ComEd, and then these lobbyists would also be out raising funds and helping Democrats get reelected, etc. Madigan himself was fated by ComEd. They'd have a big fundraiser for him, and then the other caucuses heard about it, and they demanded fundraisers too, and they got him, but they weren't as pulling in the kind of big money that Madigan pulled in. And so it also helped that Mike Madigan's, one of his closest confidants was Mike McLean, a former state rep from Quincy, who actually lost out in the cutback amendment a year. And he became a lobbyist, and he was a ComEd lobbyist, and they were close, and they worked closely together. And then we saw in the indictment in the federal case that Madigan was getting a lot of his cronies, or a few of his cronies anyway, put into ComEd jobs that have required little or no work. And then he was getting a huge number of internships, college internships from families in his 13th ward. And then one that is really cuts to the heart of many questions is that ComEd, a state-regulated utility, eventually put a person on the board of directors of this utility that Madigan had pushed very hard to get on. They resisted for a while, and he kept pushing, and McLean kept pushing, and they eventually gave in. And one of the quotes that's caught in the federal case is the CEO of ComEd, Ann Promajori, saying, you do good things for us, and we'll do good things for you, something to that effect. And that all came out actually in July of 2020 when ComEd agreed to pay a $200 million fine to the U.S. government and admitted and acknowledged that they had been trying to woo Madigan and trying to get favorable, get him to look favorably upon their legislation by, you know, doing all these kinds of things like putting people on the payroll and putting them on the board of directors, etc., to help them push through their legislative package. Now, Madigan denies it, of course, and all of these are allegations, but ComEd's agreeing to pay the fine, and in that case in July 2020, we saw Madigan named as public official A, which, of course, really put the heat on him, as you noted.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ray, we're out of time, and what I'd like to suggest is perhaps I've got several more questions here. Maybe we could come back and do a part two of this at your convenience. We can continue talking about these. I really appreciate it. It's great insights into really the predominant figure of Illinois politics over the last 50 years. Ray Long has been my guest today, and we'll bring him back and talk about some other parts of this book. He's a veteran reporter in Illinois, chronicling Illinois politics and government over a number of years. He's currently with the Chicago Tribune, and he's the author of a book called The House That Madigan Built, The Record Run of Illinois' Velvet Hammer. Ray, we'll hopefully talk soon and get back on some of the other topics in this book.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.